Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Hello, genies, and welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio, America's family history show, where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. My name is Fisher. I am your radio root sleuth, and very excited about the show we have for you this week. If you are among the 1 in 60 Americans who had an orphaned ancestor who became a rider on the orphan train, you're going to learn a ton about that entire chapter in American history that lasted from a few years before the Civil War to just a few months before the Great Depression. My guests this week, Allison Moore and Phil Lancaster. They travel the country to tell the story of the orphan train riders in both word and song. Only a handful of riders are still living, of course, and are very old. We'll talk about them, how it all started in New York City, what the experience was typically like for the kids, and what finally ended the institution. Even if you didn't have an ancestor that was part of this amazing child relocation program, you will find it fascinating. We'll begin with Allison in about 10 minutes. And of course, Tom Perry, our preservation authority, has some great advice on preserving your records later in the show. This week in American history, Benedict Arnold became, well, Benedict Arnold. Back in September of 1780, Arnold met with British Major John Andre for a discussion on handing over West Point to the Redcoats. What made him become the most famous traitor since Brutus or Judas? Well, the debts rung up by his wife's lavish lifestyle, apparently, as well as the fact that he was passed over for promotion in favor of men of lesser rank five times. Had Arnold's plot succeeded, there might not be a DAR or SAR, and we might still be singing Hail to the Queen or King. But he didn't, and so we don't. If you have a family story you'd like to share, we would love to hear from you and maybe even have you on the show. You can email me at fisher@extremegenes.com. Drop us a note at our Extreme Genes Facebook page. And by the way, be sure to give us a like and join our growing Extreme Genes community. Or you can call our Extreme Genes fine line at 1-234-56-GENES. That's 1-234-56-GENES, G-E-N-E-S. It is time once again for our family histoire news from the pages of ExtremeGenes.com. We begin with a story of an American woman who has had to come to terms with having British ancestors who fought on behalf of Canada against Americans in the War of 1812. The Welland Tribune newspaper of Canada has a wonderful article about Barbara Haney of Alaska. From the town of North Pole, honest, Barbara learned that her third great-grandfather and his two brothers participated in a British victory over the United States in a battle that helped give shape to Canada. Barbara said it was a difficult thing for her to embrace these family members as they fought against her native land. But as she came to understand they were just farmers stuck in the middle of the conflict, she empathized with their point of view. Barbara's father was Canadian, having been raised on the Canadian side of Niagara Falls in Ontario, and as a schoolboy, he had been told that his family had played a role in the War of 1812. That information was shared with Barbara, who picked up the family history bug in the 90s. Her research took her to the family of Isaac Haney, who had six sons, including her ancestor Leonard, her third great-grandfather. Leonard was one of the three oldest boys who all enlisted to fight for Canada. Leonard was just 16 and served with brother James as a private. The oldest brother, Matthew, was a sergeant. As Barbara understands it, they really had no choice but to fight because they lived right in the middle of the war zone and likely would have perished. For the Haneys, it was a matter of self-defense. Barbara's come to believe that all three participated in the war's most intense battles. All three also survived the conflict and lived out full lives. Leonard Haney was the first postmaster of Fenwick and assisted in establishing the Methodist Episcopal Church in Canada. A younger brother was apparently inspired by the three, who went on to have a notable military career of his own. Canada's Graveside Recognition Project was established to honor their 1812 veterans over the bicentennial period. Barbara applied on behalf of the Haney brothers and received approval for all three, meaning plaques have been scheduled to be unveiled at the graves of the brothers in the area of Fenwick, Ontario, this weekend. Vox.com has an interesting take on family history DNA testing written by George Doe, an anonymous name for an American biologist who decided to give the gift of a family DNA test to his family. As part of a class he was teaching on the genome, Dr. Doe did what many of us have done, spit into a cup and sent it off to a DNA company for analysis of ethnic background and potential matches with other contributors. He sent his parents a kit as well as a gift. Aside from learning he didn't have a predisposition to cancer, Dr. Doe also learned he had a half-brother named Thomas, tied to his father's side. His father was apparently unaware that he had another son out there. Thomas had been seeking his birth family for years. Dr. Doe's initial reaction was, "How cool is this?" But as it turned out, not so cool at all. As a result of the discovery, all kinds of negative emotions were magnified. Dr. Doe's parents divorced. The other children haven't spoken to their father since. His gift had destroyed the family. His point is that family history DNA tests can actually be viewed as advanced paternity tests. His conclusion is that opting in for finding close relatives should be filled with warnings because, after all, who can anticipate all the possible consequences of the results, including people finding that their parents aren't their parents, that they have previously unknown siblings or children out there, and that not everyone might react to such news the way you think they might. Definitely food for thought. Read both of these stories now, linked at extremegenes.com. And coming up next, we begin our conversation with Alison Moore and Phil Lancaster, who tour the country speaking and singing about the writers on the orphan train. Whether you're among the 1 in 60 Americans who descend from these orphan children or have never heard of the institution, you'll find the story incredible. We'll start with Alison in about 5 minutes on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com, America's Family History Show.
Once I rode an orphan train, and my brother did the same. They split us up in misery. James was 5 and I was 3. Maybe this town will be my home. Maybe someone would call my name. Maybe I'll be riding forever, riding on the orphan train, riding on the orphan train.
Hey, you have found us, Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, and ExtremeGenes.com, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. Very excited to have on the show humanities speakers Phil Lancaster and Alison Moore. They are going around the country and spreading the word about the writers on the orphan train. And Alison, great to have you on the show.
It's great to be here.
This is a fascinating thing. We ran into each other, of course, at the FGS conference in San Antonio, and I learned a little about what you talk about. And you travel the country yourself. You're almost like train riders yourselves.
We're on a whistle-stop tour in Minnesota as we speak.
Is that right? Well, tell us about the orphan train, what the era was, what it did. I think it's a fascinating story.
It is still not in history books, and that's one of the reasons why we do what we do. It's not taught in schools. In the mid-1800s, there was an enormous problem of overcrowding in New York, partly due to all of the immigration coming in, and you can trace that back to the Irish potato famine.
Right.
But there were other factors, and just overcrowding and disease and terrible living conditions and the lack of extended families in America from these people coming over, so that when one parent died, either women in childbirth died all the time, men died on the job, there was no extended family to take these children in. So there was an estimated 30,000 children fending for themselves on the streets of New York in the mid-1800s, and the public institutions at the time, juvenile asylums and so forth, were just bursting at the seams.
And so they made a decision to put these kids on trains, and off they would go. And how would this work?
Well, the decision actually came about from a minister, Charles Loring Brace, who was a Methodist minister, just come to New York from seminary, saw these conditions and knew that this was going to be his life's work. He formed the Children's Aid Society, which is basically, you could say, a nonprofit, non-denominational organization.
What year are we talking about here, Allison?
1853.
Okay.
That is when he started the Children's Aid Society. And because he was a friend of Charles Darwin and Emerson, he had this very radical thinking at the time that environment might play a big part in the formation of character of a child. And so he believed strongly that if these children were removed from this terrible situation in New York and from public institutions and placed out, that's what he called it, into rural areas in the farmlands, that they might have a chance to better themselves.
And so you had these tens of thousands of kids. At what point did they decide we're going to put them on trains and with really no destination initially? Am I interpreting that right?
They didn't have specific places. They were getting reduced passage from the railroad companies, who were only too happy to comply. They were trying to develop new towns out in the Midwest, certainly. And 1854 was in October, was the very first train that went out to Dowagiac, Michigan, with 44 children aboard.
When they got to Michigan, what happened?
They took them, in that case, to a church and lined them up, and people came and chose which ones they wanted. Now, there would have been handbills posted in that town probably 2 weeks prior, and there might have been a notice in the newspaper, you know, friendless children will arrive, please come and see them.
Wow. And so what happens, though, to the kids who were not picked?
They were put back on the train and went down to the next stop and the next until they were all taken. If there were some left at the end of that particular train line, they would go back to New York, be placed in an orphanage, and possibly go out again at a different time.
Now, what were some of the reasons that people would reject a child all the way down the line?
Some people were only coming to get children to work on the farms or help in the household. So certainly they were looking at boys to be strong, to look like they could handle a plow, perhaps. And so I would say that children who looked in any way weak or sick certainly would not be chosen. So they were really trying to put children on the train that they felt would have the best chance.
What an unbelievable thing. Now, what about the girls? What were they looking for in the girls?
Well, they didn't take girls over 12 years old for two reasons. They thought maybe that they would already be streetwise if they were older, but they also certainly were aware of the potential for abuse. And so they tried to limit the girls to a younger age. The boys, they would take up to about age 16 or 17.
And so this started then. The first train was in October of 1854. And how long did these orphan trains run?
The Children's Aid Society sent out trains for 76 years, and their last train went to Sulphur Springs, Texas in 1929.
What brought the end to this whole thing?
The demise of what we call the placing out system, which now we call the orphan trains, had to do with legislation that was being passed in Washington for the first time, Aid to Families with Dependent Children Act, that gave federal funds to help keep families and their children together. But there were also laws being passed forbidding the transportation of minors across state lines. But I also need to make sure I mention here that there was another organization that was very involved in this, but they started a little bit later than the Children's Aid Society. In 1869, the Sisters of Charity from the New York Foundling Hospital that were taking in large numbers of babies and wanting to send them to Catholic families specifically started their system that they called the Mercy Trains or the Baby Trains. And these children were sent to specific places to specific people through the agents of priests in towns across the country who would find people in their congregations, their parishes, who would apply for a child. And this was known as an indenture system.
Okay.
meaning that the children were bound to them and they to them, although in both organizations, adoption was not the norm.
Hmm. We're talking to Allison Moore and Phil Lancaster. They're the humanities scholars on Riders on the Orphan Train, which is an amazing story, as you've been hearing. Started in 1854, went to 1929. How many kids over all those years, Allison, did you say?
A conservative estimate is 250,000.
Whoa! So there are potentially millions of descendants of these kids who rode on the orphan trains.
They estimate 5 million descendants.
5 million. So that would be one out of every 60 Americans?
Well, you're a better mathematician than I am.
That would be about right. That's amazing. Now, the question always comes up because this show's about family history. How do people find their orphan train riders?
There are people who have come forward with orphan train stories, realizing that that's the way they came. Remember that these children, if they were old enough to remember anything, knew that they were on a train with a few other kids and that they found a home. Many were too young to remember. Many were never told that that's the way that they were taken into a family. So it's organizations that are holding reunions still, although there's very few orphan train riders left today, that are creating the awareness among these people that they were part of the largest child migration in history.
That's right. You got to look at it that way. How many orphan train riders are still living, do you think?
5 in Minnesota, 2 in Texas, 1 in Arizona, 1 in Louisiana, and there certainly could be others. But I want to go back to your question about how people find out. They could start with the National Orphan Train Complex Museum and Research Center in Concordia, Kansas. We are their official outreach program, and people can start with them. But anybody who knows that they are within 2 generations of an orphan train rider can write to either the Children's Aid Society or the New York Foundling Hospital, prove that they are who they are, that they know that this is the story that they have heard in their family, and that organization in New York will either approve or disapprove and lead you further down the line to get records. But the New York Historical Society now has those records, and it's gotten easier to get a hold of them, but you have to be within direct descendant line to get access to them.
Now, does that include kids who were born way back in the 1800s as well?
Yes.
Their records are still sealed too?
Yes.
Wow, that is a strange law, isn't it?
Yeah. New York is very, very stringent.
Are they working on changing that?
Well, there were people at the FGS conference who were all worked up about it. We taught a class with descendants about doing the searching, and it was quite a strong feeling among them that this needs to be lobbied.
All right. Well, we're talking to Allison Moore and Phil Lancaster, the Riders on the Orphan Train Humanity Scholars. And Allison, we'll talk to Phil, I guess, coming up next.
Yeah.
And find out some specific stories about some of these individuals and what happened to them, and maybe some of the ones that you've met who are still living and obviously quite old.
Yes.
When we return in 5 minutes on Extreme Genes, Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. We are back. Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com, America's Family History Show. I am Fisher. And on the line with me right now is Phil Lancaster. We've been talking to Phil and his wife, Allison, about Riders on the Orphan Train. And good to meet you, Phil. Good to have you along.
Thank you very much for having us be a part of your show.
Well, we've been hearing all about this amazing thing that so many Americans have been affected by, and maybe in many cases don't even realize it. I thought it'd be kind of fun to hear about some of the specific stories of individuals who rode this train, and some of them who are still living today but quite aged. Fill us in on what you know.
First off, we have probably in Texas, in Caldwell, Texas, the oldest living orphan train rider that we know of. Her name is Mary Marish, and she came out Mary Delaney. She was 18 months old when she came to Rosenberg, Texas. She still has the little dress and the coat and the knitted mittens that she wore, and she's 105.
Wow.
And then this past spring, we met. Allison had a conference to do in a little town in Wharton, Texas, and a 93-year-old woman showed up who is Beatrice Flanagan Feistig. And so she showed up, and so we now know that we have two in Texas. We're very well acquainted with Alice Bernard in Louisiana, 98 years old, living in Lafayette. And then we know of Vicky Moe, who was in Minnesota and is now out in Sun City, Arizona. She's 102. So those are the folks that we know mostly of that we've had contact with, and I know that there are others out there. Allison and I used to say 17 years ago when we started our program that this is an 11th hour situation for these folks, and now we have to say it's more like 5 minutes till midnight.
Yes, yes. Now, I would assume you're out and gathering oral histories of their situation. Describe for us what they say to you the trip was like, those who can even remember it.
Well, that's the problem. Most of the folks that we know now were too young to remember those stories coming out. That's why Allison and I, 17 years ago, were lucky enough to meet a lot of orphan train riders so that we were able to get their stories. We've had several different situations where we had, for example, two cousins, they called themselves, of orphan train riders that came to Wellington, Texas. They came to our program when we did our Riders on the Orphan Train there. And what they told us was one of the sweetest stories we think we've heard, which was their uncle had come into town just simply to get provisions as usual in Wellington and saw all of this commotion over at the train station and went over there and found out what was going on, which were, here were these children that had just come from New York and they were looking for a home. So he thought to himself, well, we're doing very well right now. I could take a little boy home. So he goes and he gets a little boy by the hand and starts to walk away with him when he turns around and sees that that little boy is holding on to another little boy, his brother.
Oh.
And he was not about to let go of him. So he ends up taking both boys. And on his way home, he's thinking, well, what am I going to tell my wife?
Now, this just Wait a minute. It just occurs to him as he's on his way home?
Yes, apparently. That's the story we were told. So
we guys are always that way. You notice that? A little slow on the uptake.
Right. Spontaneous. And that was a great idea. Now what are we going to do? So it was around Christmas time, and he also already had two daughters. That was the reason why I think he took the little boys. So what he did when he got home was he covered the boys up in, I think it was a Model A that he had, and so he covered them up with a blanket and sent his little girls to go out and undo the truck. And, of course, now when they lifted up the blanket, here were these two little boys, and they thought that was the best Christmas present they could ever have.
Isn't that something? And how did that work out for those boys? Happy family?
To the best of our knowledge, it worked out really well. One of them is still alive in Pueblo, Colorado. We have yet to be able to get in touch with him, and we're looking into that because we do go through Colorado quite a bit. So, you know, to the best of our knowledge, that story worked out well. And I would have to say, and I'm not trying to make a prediction here, so many of the stories that we have actually come in contact with have all been very good. We have come across certain stories where things didn't work out so well, and one of them was a lady that we met in the very early years, and she just never would talk about it outside of the fact that she was abused, and she was in Oklahoma. So these things did happen.
Of course. The folks that when you were meeting them at the very beginning were probably in their 70s and 80s at that point.
Exactly. And some of them already in their 90s. Some of them already, I believe Lee Nailing was already 81 or 82 years old. Lee was one of the people in the PBS documentary that we saw when we first got inspired by this story. And we were lucky enough to get to go and meet Lee down in Atlanta, Texas, just outside of Texarkana, where I grew up. So we were very, very fortunate to meet some of these people. Alice Ayler, the one that I just mentioned, was also in that PBS documentary, and we got to meet her and her son. And so we've been very fortunate to have gotten to speak with these people and tell their stories. Lee actually has a book was written about him, and it was for adolescents. It's called Orphan Train Rider, One Boy's True Story. So that story is much available, but yet at the same time, we use his story in our program to kind of give a picture of what one of these situations was like.
And, of course, I would imagine it changed, of course, over many, many decades. I mean, we're talking the 1850s to the 1920s, so yeah. You're catching the very tail end of the whole thing right now. We're talking to Phil Lancaster. He and his wife, Allison Moore, are humanity scholars on Riders on the Orphan Train, and they travel the country. Do you ever take a train, by the way, Phil?
We have not, and we've always thought that the greatest idea we could, and we're going to actually submit this idea to the Smithsonian. They used to have what was called an art train that they sent out, and I think it would be wonderful to get a traveling exhibit where they're able to go and send out a train that has a permanent exhibit in it, and each town can definitely solicit that, and we would definitely love to be a part of that.
Now, is there much oral tradition that has survived from the earlier children in this, or letters that they have written, or diary entries that you have access to?
No, access is probably the most difficult. Now it has turned into an oral history project where we are getting the stories that were passed down to descendants. And then on top of that, we're getting the stories of descendants who have gone back and are doing the genealogy research. And like the two women we had with our program, Elaine Smith and Eileen Groenwald, who went back to New York to research their grandfather's story, we're getting that part of what's happening now. So many of these children were left in baskets at the Foundling Hospital and or the Children's Aid Society, as just the stories that we have found. Art Smith is one of the gentlemen we met years ago who was actually left in a basket at Gimbel's department store and then turned over. So these people don't have any paper trail whatsoever.
Right.
So from what we were finding out at the convention in San Antonio, the FGS convention, is there could be an option for these people to find descendants that would be willing to do their DNA testing and maybe jump the gap, which would mean finding relations that preceded probably this time period and then maybe work their way forward. So we don't know how this is all going to come about. We're suggesting that there be an orphan train DNA database now, and we'll see how that goes.
And where can people get in touch with you or find out more about this online?
They can simply go to www.ridersontheorphantrain.org. That is our website. There is www.orphantraindepot.org.
What a great adventure you and Allison are on. And thank you so much for your time, Phil, and sharing all this information with us on the Riders on the Orphan Train.
Thank you very much, Scott. We really appreciate you getting in touch with us.
And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here with Tom Perry. He is our preservation authority from TMCPlace.com. Fresh off the train. Hi, Tom. Good to see you again.
Good to be here. Glad I made that last train.
Yes. We might sound like we're stuttering a little bit today because we're talking about discs and dies.
Right. Discs have die and discs do die.
Yes, they do. And there's a lot of things we have to worry about when it comes to preserving video and audio and digital data, because we've been learning so much the last few weeks. These things have a very short shelf life, generally speaking, except that you talk about Tyoyutin discs as being significantly different and better than anything else.
Absolutely. We've been using those since they came out, I guess, about 20 years ago. I have never had even one come back, which is a miracle, because no matter how good something is, whether it's a Maserati or a Ferrari, there's going to be lemons. But fortunately, we have not had one come back, because we always have a warranty on all of our discs that we guarantee that if it ever fails, bring your stuff back, we'll retransfer it for you, and there'll be no charge. That's another reason why you still want to keep your original stuff. Just because you have an old videotape you put onto a DVD or some old film or slides you put onto a DVD or CDs, don't throw them away, especially stuff like slides and photos, because there's always going to be better technology. They'll be able to do a better resolution that will make the things look better. Plus, if something happens to your disc and you didn't back it up like we tell you to do constantly on this show, you still got your master to go back to and make a new one.
That's right. I mean, nothing kills me more than I hear somebody transferred something and threw away the original, and then the disc dies.
Exactly. And we've had that happen even in our store, where somebody transferred something. The disc didn't fail on its own. that it took little two-year-old Jimmy to gnaw through the disc and damage the disc or get the disc and break it in half.
Ooh.
So even if you have the Ten Commandments on stone, if you break those apart, they're broken. They're going to be a lot harder to read. So always back stuff up. Don't think I've got it here. Nothing's going to happen to it. But we have people with game discs, with family photos they've transferred that, you know, little Jimmy chewed on the disc and actually damaged the disc. Or we've had people that had a disc and they wrote on it with a ballpoint pen with so much pressure that they damaged the foil layer of the disc.
Wow.
And it's unreadable. So the disc didn't fail on its own. Nothing wrong with the disc. It's somebody did some kind of a brute force to the disc and ruined it. So you want to be really, really careful. In fact, I recommend people that have the minivans that have little TVs in them and they have a lot of DVDs. You can buy these shields just like you buy for your iPhone that protects them. They call them bullet shields. They make them for discs. Put them on the label side of the disc. So if they're loose in your cars and your kids' feet are on them, if they get scratched, we can repair the disc and it'll still work. But if the top side, the label side, gets scratched and it gets into the foil label, like writing on it hard with a ballpoint pen.
Right, it'll go right through it.
It'll go right through it. It'll damage the disc. And, you know, you can hold up the disc from the back side and you can actually read backwards what the guy wrote on it. And that's why the disc wouldn't work anymore. And he did this on every single one of his copies. So he had to bring his tape back in. We had to retransfer his tape and give him a new master because he had destroyed his master and all of his duplicates by writing on it with a ballpoint pen.
All right. So we got CDs and we got DVDs.
And Blu-ray.
And Blu-ray.
And soon to come, quartz.
Okay. And so among those, which would you recommend?
It depends what you're doing. If you're doing really small files, CDs are great ways to go because then it's basically a data disk. And the thing with a CD, since it's smaller, there's actually less things to go wrong with it. I see a lot fewer CDs fail than DVDs because they don't need as high grade of a die in them, and they work really well. When you start getting into video, you start getting into large size files, there's more stuff that's cramped onto that little disc, and so there's more chances that something can go wrong with it. So you want to be really, really careful and always back them up with a lot of stuff.
So we've been talking about the D's today, the discs and the dies, and we were covering some of the four different things. We got CDs, DVDs, Blu-rays, and quartz. How am I doing?
Exactly.
Okay, and you covered a couple of them. Pick it up.
Okay, as we mentioned, size matters. CDs are usually 700 megabytes. DVDs are usually 4.5 gigabytes. And a little helper to you guys that do your own DVD burning. Now remember, even though it's 4.5 gigabytes, you'll never get a full 4.5 gigabytes of information on it because a disk needs information to say, okay, this is what I'm going to do. He's starting a new thing here. I'm at the end of the DVD. Now what am I supposed to do? So there's information that has to be written on the disk in order to finalize it, to make it usable, to play on other people's machines. So you're only going to have maybe, say, 4.25 gigabytes. But then also you want to be careful, too, is if you're using a lot of titles, even though the titles don't play on the TV, they're more like when you put them in a computer so you can read different addresses. That takes up room on the disk as well. So if you have some home movies that you did and you put each one in its own like 5 or 10 minute segment, every 5 or 10 minutes you have another title that only shows up on the DVD when it's injected into the computer, your DVD player. That's taking up room, so you could end up with only 3.5 gigabytes of storage on your DVD.
So how do you decide how much you can fit on one of these?
What I usually do is I usually say, don't go over an hour and a half if you're doing your own DVDs. If you're going to a professional studio, usually they can go to 2 hours because they have a little bit more flexibility of how to make files smaller, but yet they still look good. But if you're working at home and you're going to be doing a lot of editing in Final Cut Pro or any of those kind of programs, I say try to limit yourself to about an hour and a half. If you see you're about an hour 40, an hour 45, you're okay. But if you're right there at about an hour and a half and you think this is a good place to start a new DVD, do it. Go ahead and start a new DVD than trying to cram a whole nother 30 minutes in there where you're going to end up having all kinds of problems. It's not going to fit. You're not going to be able to get it finalized and it won't work. And another thing I suggest, which we don't even talk about on this show, is don't use dual layer DVDs. There's too many problems with them. We have more customers.
What are they, first of all, Tom?
What it's called, it's a dual-layer DVD. Basically, what you're doing with a dual-layer disc, it's reading at a right angle. So it's starting at the center of the ring and reading out on like a right angle. Then it stops, reverses the laser to go more on a left angle and reads it all the way back towards the middle. And so you have two things that are being laid down. They're twice the size. A lot of duplicators won't even duplicate them. A lot of computers won't even read them. So stay away from dual-layer DVDs. We had a big contract with Microsoft several years ago. We were proofing a whole bunch of new game discs that were coming out. and they wanted to release these at a big party they were having, but they weren't ready to really replicate them yet, which is when you physically stamp out the discs. So they asked us to do a whole bunch of duplicating. It's a game disc, so it's huge. So we had to use dual-layer discs, and we had probably 20% failure rate in the discs. So that was a lot of discs going in the garbage, a lot of time loss, and some machines just won't play dual-layer discs. So I really recommend stay away from dual-layer discs. They cost more to duplicate. They cost more to replicate. It's going to be cheaper to make two DVDs, each one an hour and a half, than making one dual-layer disc that's going to be 3 hours. So try and stay away from that. The inconvenience of having two discs outweighs the inconvenience of having that one disc that won't play.
Wow.
And then also remember, too, we talked about this a few months ago. Over in England, they've developed a quartz disc, which is 365 terabytes.
I can't even get my brain around that. That's
and it's
amazing.
A rock. So it's like we talked about a couple of weeks ago with Rick from the Preservation with the LDS Church. This is a quartz rock. This is not dye. This will be around forever. This is as good as riding on a rock. So this quartz is a rock. So once it's engraved, it'll be there forever. It'll be the best way to preserve it once it makes it to the market.
All right. Great stuff. Thanks so much, Tom. We have run out of time. Thanks for joining us this week. Talk to you again next time around. Remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.